Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Great to see you here. I've got 25 minutes. Let's push through. So, quest for meaning, dead ends and answers. I thought we might start with some culture. Here's a poem that I kind of learned at school. Let me read this to you. I met a traveller from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear, 'My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair.'" Nothing beside remains around the decay of that colossal wreck. Boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. Interesting to think about, written by Percy Shelley in 1818. Actually, there's a sad story about him. He drowned at the age of just 29, so in a little sailing boat and caught in a storm, and he drowned. Now, what's it all about? Well, the sand stretches, everything fades away. Ultimately, the sand wins, everything passes away. Now, I think about things like that when I'm at the beach. You might think, what's going on? Well, when I'm at the beach in January with Oscar and Jesse, they're my grandkids, and I do think they're the cutest kids in the world. Oscar's 7, Jesse's 5, and they are demon sandcastle builders. As you can see, here's Oscar. He gets pretty keen about sandcastles and things. Okay. Now, I'm Gung Gung, because Kathy's Chinese. I'm Gung Gung, she's Paw Paw. Okay, you'll understand that if you're from a Cantonese background. She's a much better Paw Paw than I am Gung Gung. Why? Because Kathy's right into sandcastle building with them. She gets in there and digs away, and I just can't really get into it. Why? Well, Oscar and Jesse haven't worked it out yet, but they don't last. And have you ever noticed, if you go to the beach, that adults without kids don't build sandcastles? Okay, they did. Why? Well, we're smarter than them. We're older. We've worked out it's not going to last at all. I wonder, folks, have you ever felt like all of life is a little like that? That nothing really lasts, or it all seems temporary, or it's all gone. My favourite sci-fi movie. Well, wait a minute. Does anyone know who that is or what movie that's from? Can you do it? Yes, sir? Well done. Blade Runner. Actually, the original one, 1982. The best sci-fi movie ever made. That's Rutger Hauer playing Roy Batty. And at the end, there's this scene where he's in the rain and he's going to die. I don't want to spoil it for you, but he's going to die. And he's talking about all the things that he's seen out in the solar system. And it's a beautiful speech. And he says at the end, all of these things will be washed away like tears in the rain. And that, apparently they said the camera crew was there when he filmed it. There were people who wept. Okay, so if you want to see the best sci-fi movie ever made, 1982, Blade Runner. But you say, I wonder how much, so much of our life will be just washed away like tears in the rain. Now, I just wonder whether we're actually hardwired up to look for something permanent, something that gives life purpose and meaning. That's what I'd like to talk to you about today. What is it that really lasts? What gives life purpose? What gives life meaning? What won't be washed away? Well, there's Blade Runner 1982. What won't be washed away like tears in the rain or like sandcastles on the beach? Where you look for purpose or meaning will very much depend upon your worldview. Okay, so the worldview, the way that you see the world, what you believe will affect what you believe about purpose and meaning. And what I'd like to do is look at three or four different ways of seeing the world and show how that works itself out in what gives meaning or purpose, or perhaps what doesn't give meaning or purpose. So let's pick one, for example. A very high-profile worldview at the moment would be the way that the new atheists see the world. So you may remember in 2009 in London and in a few other cities around the world, it didn't make it here to Australia, there was a bus campaign and Professor Richard Dawkins, who's in many ways, I guess, the spokesman for the new atheist movement. He sponsored it. They raised enough money. I think they raised around £100,000, something like that. And here's the signs that they put on the buses. There's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life. There's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life. What I thought I'd do just for a moment or two is, okay, let's assume that there's no God, that Professor Dawkins and others are absolutely right. Where does that, if we chase that rabbit down the rabbit hole, just and follow the logic of that, where do we end up? Where does that rabbit hole take us if we go that way? Well, here's a man who's trying to do that. Alex Rosenberg is a professor of philosophy at Duke University, Carolina in the USA. And he's written this book, and I've waded my way through this, 313 pages, The Atheist's Guide to Reality, Enjoying Life Without Illusions. What he's saying is if you're a hardcore, consistent atheist, where does that lead you? What are the logical conclusions of that? Now, his starting point is scientism. Here's what scientism is, and this is a direct quote from him. He says, scientism, this is the conviction that the methods of science are the only reliable ways to secure knowledge of anything. Got that? So it's only science can actually give us the facts. So he basically says the laws of physics and what we know about physics give us chemistry. Chemistry gives us biology. Biology gives us life and who we are, and it's kind of, it's all there. But it's only science can give you anything that's genuinely a fact. And so inside your head, there's brain cells and synapses and electricity on and off, etc., and chemicals moving around, and that's about it. Now, what does he say? What's the implications of that for meaning and purpose, etc.? He says this, the neural circuits in our brain manage the beautifully coordinated and smoothly appropriate behaviour of our body. They also produce the entrancing, introspective illusion, and notice he says illusion, that thoughts really are about stuff in the world. Like, if it's just brain cells and electricity on and off, how can it be about anything? He goes on, this powerful illusion has been with humanity since language kicked in, as we'll see. It's the source of at least two other profound myths, that we have purposes that give our actions and lives meaning, and that there is a person, quote, in there steering the body, so to speak. Do you notice any idea of purpose or meaning just disappeared because that's an illusion, and the you that's in there listening to this talk, or, well, you were 5 minutes ago. I can see a few screensavers have gone on, okay. But you don't really exist. You're just an illusion. Okay? Well, let's go a little bit further. He says, the self whose existence introspection is so sure of is not physical. And you just think that you're there. Really, you're just chemicals and brain cells, and that, okay, that's an illusion. None of the alleged facts about it are fixed by physics. Ergo, the alleged facts about the self are not facts at all. They are mistakes. There is no self, soul, person. Scientism must firmly deny its existence. The self, as conveyed to us by introspection, is a fiction. It doesn't exist. You just disappear in a puff of scientism. Once you start with that a priori point that he started at, the logic flows beautifully. Let's keep going. He says, but if the physical facts fix all the facts, there can't be a me or a you inside our bodies with a special point of view. When it fixed the facts, physics ruled out the existence of selves, souls, persons, or non-physical minds inhabiting our bodies. And as for free will, it's also hard to see its point without a self to have free will. So all of a sudden, you don't have free will. You didn't, thanks for coming, but you didn't decide to today, okay? It's just the chemicals in your head and what happened yesterday and the day before. And so thanks for being here, but you didn't choose it. Now, can you think about that? So if you take scientism, you actually can't relate to other people that way, can you? Because all of a sudden, someone says they love you. Well, they didn't choose that. It's just the chemicals in their head. Someone commits a crime. How can you punish them? They didn't choose to do it. It's just their free will just disappeared. Well, there is no self. So where does he end up? He says this. You'll seek to avoid or minimize. And by the way, these are all direct quotes from the book. And if you hold that worldview, I'd love you to read the book. It's just wonderful to see where the logic leads. You'll seek to avoid, minimise or reduce unhappiness, pain, discomfort and distress in all its forms. If so, scientism has good news. There's an ever-increasing pharmacopoeia. What a great word. I think that means a whole bunch of drugs, okay? Pharmacopoeia of drugs, medicines, treatments, prosthetic devices and regimes that will avoid, minimise or reduce these unwanted conditions. Take them. Saying if scientism makes you feel sad, take the drugs, okay? And if you feel guilty for seeking surcease from the thousand natural shocks that flesh and especially grey matter are subject to, well, there's probably a drug that reduces such guilt feelings too. My point is that at the end of it, it's actually unlivable. You can't relate to people that way. You can't operate as if you don't actually exist, and yet it's all quite logical. But I'll tell you what I felt like at the end. 313 pages of detailed argument that he gives onto a book, and then I read all 313 pages from his consciousness through the book into my consciousness for him to convince me that neither of us actually exist. Now, but it feels like you're writing to me from your honeymoon to convince me that marriage isn't real. Okay, anyway, that's one rabbit hole to chase. Here's a very different understanding of purpose or meaning. Viktor Frankl. Viktor Frankl is an Austrian Jewish man who's a psychiatrist. He was locked up in Nazi concentration camps, in the death camps in the Second World War, spent 3 years, including time in Auschwitz and Dachau. It's a reasonably short book. It's sold millions of copies. Well, you've got 12 million in print, and it's worth reading. It's not particularly gruesome, but he's got some great insights into human nature and how and why people survived. I thought survival in the death camps was random, but it's not. If you stayed strong enough to work, the Nazis would keep you alive so you could work. It's when you couldn't work they would kill you, you'd be gassed, burned, etc. Here's what he says. A lot of what he did was to try and keep other inmates in the camps alive. And after the war, he started this thing called logos therapy. Logos is from the Greek word about rationality or meaning or so on. He says logotherapy focuses on the meaning of human existence as well as on man's search for meaning. According to logotherapy, this striving to find a meaning in one's life is the primary motivational force in man. I'm sorry, it's man. He wrote it 60 years ago before gender-inclusive language. He's saying it's the meaning in life that kept them going. And he'll say in the book that when one of the people that he was with in the camp, when they lost hope and lost purpose in life, they would literally just lie down and die. It was purpose that kept them going. And he's saying what his book will say is the more extreme circumstances, the more people need purpose to keep going. Okay, that's the second one. A third one. Jordan Peterson. Would you just like to kind of nod your head if you've heard of Jordan Peterson or... Okay, some of you have. Some of you haven't been on the internet for 6 months. You might like to switch it on, okay? Get on the line, as they say. Jordan Peterson is a lecturer in psychology at Toronto University. He's just the flavour of the month on the net. Some of his lectures on YouTube have 1.7 million views. His book, 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos, is the best-selling non-fiction book on the planet this year. Just to have a look. He's a very interesting man in what he says, etc. This idea of making sense for life, rule number 7, he says this, pursue what is meaningful, not what is expedient. Pursue what is meaningful, not what is expedient. Now, what does he mean? And this has been embraced by... Well, particularly the millennials and particularly young men, as to kind of what's life all about. He says this, expedience is the following of blind impulse. It's short-term gain, it's narrow and selfish, it lies to get its way, it takes nothing into account, it's immature and irresponsible. Meaning is its mature replacement. Meaning emerges when impulses are regulated, organised and unified. Saying it's when you start to think about the future and getting life in order, that's when you begin to find meaning. Meaning signifies that you're in the right place at the right time, properly balanced between order and chaos, and everything lines up as best it can at that moment. Now, as far as I can tell, Jordan Peterson is not a Christian, although he takes the Bible, has respect for the Bible. Interesting book, and particularly it's about finding meaning and purpose in life. Best-selling book on the planet this year. So there you go. There's some worldviews. Okay, the scientism and the implications of it. I'll put it to you, it's actually unlivable. You disappear in a puff of scientism, it's unlivable. Why? Viktor Frankl saying the search for meaning is our primary motivation, and the more extreme, the more important it is. And Jordan Peterson, well, there's millions of people lining up to buy his books or listen to his lectures, it's still a driving force for people. Okay, now if you probably feel a bit like you've been drinking from a fire hose, okay, so, well, it probably gets worse from now on. Anyway, what I'd like to do now, for the last one, I want to take a step back 3,000 years with you. I want to look at a document that's possibly around about 3,000 years old. In fact, it's inside your program. If you open up the A5 program, the white one, there's the part of the Old Testament that I'd like to look at with you. The Bible writers are aware of our need to find purpose and meaning and why it's so important to us. And one book in the Old Testament in particular, it's a part of the wisdom literature. The wisdom literature is about trying to make sense of the world. The Old Testament tends to be a big, long story, a history of ancient Israel. But there's also some books like Proverbs and others that say, well, what's the wise life look like? Now, the book of Ecclesiastes on the left-hand side of your program, that's the first chapter. Ecclesiastes is about the search for meaning or purpose. It's written either by King Solomon, who lived around about 950 BC, either by Solomon or through the eyes of King Solomon. He is the richest king in ancient Israel. And it's about Solomon applying the sandcastle test to life. The sandcastle idea being, what is it that really lasts? What's permanent? What will really give our lives lasting purpose? So I thought what I might do is just read the beginning with you, read that chapter one, make a few comments, and then I'm going to actually invite you, if you'd like to read this book of Ecclesiastes. Okay, let's have a look. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. And Solomon was a son of King David. King in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Now, that word meaningless, it's a little bit hard to, originally written in Hebrew, and it's a little hard to translate the word that's given there as meaningless. It's the Hebrew word hebel, or however, that's how you say it with an Aussie accent, hebel. What's it mean? It means a mist or a vapour, something that doesn't last. It's like, you know, on a really cold morning, you breathe out and you can see the breath or the mist come from your mouth and then it's gone. Or in the mornings, if I drive past some of the sporting fields near our house and in the wintertime, you can see the mist. Yeah? Come back half an hour later, the mist is gone. And what he's saying is all of life feels like that. It feels like nothing lasts. It's a mist. It's hard to get hold of. Nothing's permanent. Why is that? And he's saying that's what life feels like. Well, then he begins to look at the world and say, well, why does he think that? He says, what do people gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun? Now, under the sun, that little phrase there, that occurs 27 times in the book. It's only 12 short chapters. What's he mean? Well, if you just look out the window on a sunny day, what do you see? Just eyes open, common sense switched on. What does the world seem like under the sun? Without special revelation or anything like that, what's the way of the world? How do you make sense of it out there under the sun? And the word gain is kind of a commercial term. He's almost saying, like under the sun, what's the bottom line? What's actually left? What's the take home? You work really hard, you commute in and out of town. If you're a worker, I've worked out, you probably do about 10,000 commutes. There you go, you can work out which one you're up to. 200 a year or 250 a year, anyway, 10,000. What's left? You do all of that work under the sun, what's the bottom line? What do you have left at the end of it all? Okay, what really lasts? So he goes to have a look at the world. Says this, okay, generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. Like we come and go, we argue about who owns what piece of land and everything, but we're not here very long. We're only here for 5 minutes. on a holiday, Kathy and I and our kids went to Uluru. And the hardest thing about visiting Uluru is actually finding a parking spot. Okay, there's a lot of tourists out there, as you can see. And we paid for this Indigenous man, an Aboriginal man, to take our little group around the rock and tell us a whole lot of stuff that was going on. It was great. He showed us how they, you know, would make a spear and this and that and use different parts of a kangaroo to do things, and very interesting. And what he said they call, the locals call the tourists ants, A-N-T-S, you know, like insects. And it didn't quite make sense until we went to the tourist office. And you walk in and what they've got is a video of tourists arriving. They've got to speed it up to maybe four or five or six times. And you can see, and from a distance, okay, you've got all the tourist buses there, and then you see, and the tourist buses arrive and the tourists get out and then they take all these photos and they walk around and some walk over the rock and then back, and then they walk in the tourist shop and then they mill around and then they get back on the bus and they go. And it's like all these little... And guess what? The rock does not move. And folks, the Earth's here forever, and we are bugs hitting the windscreen of eternity, okay? Life is very short. And what's it like? Well, it repeats again and again and again. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north, and round it goes, ever returning on its course. What's he saying? Well, it's not so much the reliability of nature. There's other parts of the Bible that talk about that, and it's understanding the laws of nature that made the rise of science possible. What's he saying here is it just repeats again and again and again. The synoptic chart goes around and around. It's Groundhog Day, if you've seen that movie. Things around and around and around. All streams flow into the sea, and yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. Do you know what? You can get bored with anything. You think of the most exciting thing that you can possibly do, and you can get bored with it. I'll give you an example for us. Okay, I'm the world's worst fisherman. I think I could say that. We went to Broome. We're up at Derby, way up in the Kimberleys, top left-hand corner of Australia. And you see the jetty in the background. The rise and fall of tides up there is between 8 and 12 metres in 6 hours. Okay, so we paid money, and the guides on the left, this is my Kathy here, long-suffering lady, and we're going barramundi fishing. Okay, so we're going to pay this guy all this money. We're going to catch a barramundi. It's the only way I'll ever do it. But okay, so we get out there. We're powering along. We come to a river, sandy river. The tide is coming in at walking pace. That's how quick the tide comes in, because it's going to cover 8 to 12 metres. There are crocodile slides on the bank. Okay, and so there's crocs everywhere, and the guide is showing us what to do, and then he throws the net out there and catches these little mullet and all that sort of thing, and then we're fishing for the day, and then where are we? Do you know what? I can't believe it. My picture of Kathy has dropped out. Hey, anyway, Kathy caught a barramundi, big one. Take my word for it. Would I lie to you? Okay, she's caught this fish like this, all this squealing and carry on, and we got the thing in, and I can show you a photo later on my phone if you want to see it. And it was really exciting and everything. And then, you know what? The fishing guide, he was bored out of his brain. Really? Why? Because he does it every day. And he couldn't wait. Oh, we've got to go back now. And he kind of takes us back and drops us. He was polite, but bored out of his brain. Or you go to a roller coaster park. We went to Magic Mountain in America, world's biggest roller coasters. And the staff are so excited. Yeah? No, they weren't. Boring. You get bored with anything. Bored with it. And I guarantee, you know, you go into a golf shop and the guy sitting behind the counter, he's bored. I tell you what, he loves golf. Okay? Open a golf shop, now he can't go play golf. It's just that's the way life... Anyway, all right. Look at verse 8 if you're following your program. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. It's never satisfied. If you love travel, okay, you've got the travel bug, then travelling cures it, right? No, it makes it worse. You want to go, oh, there's somewhere I haven't seen in 200 countries. I have more and more and more. Or even take something like, the ear. Let's see. Do you know, I looked up on the internet... There's 20 million songs on Spotify. 20 million. They said 4 million of them have never been played. 20 million. Okay. Now, I reckon probably a decent song hasn't been written since the 80s, but that's probably saying something about, well, apart from Bruce Springsteen, but that's saying something about me. Why do we need more? 20 million. Couldn't we just say, oh, that's it, folks, thanks for coming, we've got enough, thanks, stop. You laugh, you think, that's never going to happen. Why? Because the ear never has enough. It's never enough. Or the eyes fill of seeing. My daughter subscribes to Netflix and we piggyback on her account. Okay, I'm a cheapskate. Netflix has over 1,500 television shows and 4,000 movies. And you know what? I often turn it on, flick through, and you know what? There's nothing to watch. Seriously, you laugh because it's true, isn't it? But the eye never has enough of seeing. Okay, we'll keep going. I've got to finish up soon, Craig. Yeah. He says, so not only that, okay, we're only here for 5 minutes. We're bored while we are, and then things seem to just go round and round. There's nothing new. What has been will be again, and what has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, oh, look, this is something new? It was here already long ago. It was here before our time. So next year's a federal election, and I don't know which way you go in politics, but I guarantee there'll be politicians standing up saying, we're going to fix everything, blah, blah, everything will be wonderful. Just vote us in and it'll all be blah, 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 okay? Yeah. And so we got light rail. It's going to be fix everything wonderfully, isn't it? Why? Because we tore up the trams about 30 years ago and now we're putting them down again, and it's kind of, I don't know. Huh? You think, no, wait, technology. Technology's new. The computer, well, yeah, in one way, but you know what? Technology's just been getting better and better, or faster and faster and more powerful over the centuries. Yes, from the fishing net to the internet. Yeah, okay. You like that? I thought about that one. But you know what? It still hasn't solved our problems, has it? There's still loneliness and heartache and corruption and greed and you know what? It's easier sometimes to talk to someone on the other side of the world than it is to talk to someone on the other side of the breakfast table. And it hasn't changed us, okay? Here already long ago. Now, it's not ultimately that bad. It's worse, okay? Because no one will remember you. No one remembers the former generations. Even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. No one will remember you. You go, oh, no, that's not true. So, okay, well, here's a little quiz. Now, no one shout out. Who knows who those guys are or were? Anyone? Just raise your hand if you do. Okay. Andrew, okay. We got one out of 30-something. All right. They were Prime Ministers of Australia. Okay. So you can be Prime Minister and 100 years later, no one knows, well, sorry, one man maybe knows who you are. You can imagine 100 years' time, so Malcolm Turnbull, what, who's that? Okay, yeah, they don't remember. You think, oh, no, wait. Well, okay, here's another little test. Anyone know who this man is? Oh, it's awful. This is Jack Gibson. Jack Gibson died in 2008. He was my boyhood hero. I got to meet him a few times, and he's the greatest rugby league coach in the history of the world. That's not exaggerating, all right? And no one knows who he is. 2008, right? 10 years. Or this guy here. Does anyone know Don Lane was Mr. Television in the 60s through to the 80s? And anyone remember Don Lane? No. You think, oh, no, wait. My family will remember me. Really? Okay. In 1851, my great-great-grandparents got on a boat from the Isle of Skye, way up in the north of Scotland. Okay. I've been there. It was so cold, so cold. This is one of the little huts that I think one of them was born in. She arrived here in Australia. Her husband died on the ship coming out, and she arrived with 7 children aged 18 through to 1. The second youngest boy, aged 6, was my great-grandfather. Janet McSwan was her name. She ended up on the north coast, up at McLean somewhere. Do you know, I didn't even know that she existed until I was 45. And, of course, now my kids are really interested to know all of that. They can't get it, no. I start to talk to them about it, right? Or they're out of the room. They don't care. No one will remember you, folks. Okay. All right, so here we go. So what's his reaction? That's Solomon looks at the world, and it's a pretty depressing view. So what does he say? He says, I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. Yep, king. all the money in the world. He's super rich, okay, and had a reputation of being very, very wise. He says this, I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. I've seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are, there's the meaningless word, they don't last. It's like they're ephemeral. Meaningless, a chasing after the wind. See, what's the burden God's laid on mankind? We can see that. We can see that nothing lasts. We ultimately know that we'll die, that we won't be remembered. My Staffordshire Terrier, Musket, he's a great little dog. He's about 12 years old. He spends all the winter lying in front of the heater. And he doesn't carry that burden. He's quite happy as long as he, you know, lie in front of the heater, get his meal at night. We've got a little coat for him now. He's cold because he gets arthritis. He's perfectly happy. He doesn't carry the burden that I carry, that you carry about what's purpose, what's meaning. He says, see, what's crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. There's loneliness and heartache and the desire for meaning and purpose and what's it all about? He says, I said to myself, look, I've increased in wisdom more than anyone who's ruled over Jerusalem before me. And that's true. And I've experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. And then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also madness and folly. But I learned, so he said, I'm going to apply wisdom to this problem. He says, but I learned this too, is a chasing after the wind. And then, for with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. How often do you ever pick up a newspaper or look online and you read the news or listen to the news and after it you say, oh, I'm so much happier now that I've listened to the news. Or if you went to university, let me ask you a question. Who was the happiest? The philosophers? You know, the philosophy students? No way. They dress in black. They walk around in big books. They look haunted. They're kind of thinking about stuff. When I went to uni, the ones who really enjoyed university, the engineers. Why? They played rugby and got drunk. Okay? They didn't think about anything. Well, anyway. All right. Okay. So what do you do? So what Solomon says is this. He sets out to on a quest to find what really lasts. And he applies the sandcastle test to life. In other words, what lasts? When the tides come in and out, what's left? And he looks through all of the things that we try and find purpose and meaning in. So he looks at work or climbing the ladder to success or money or possessions or hedonism. And ultimately, he says they all get washed away. I'll tell you why. Because we get washed away. We get washed away. My wife's father died last night in Royal North Shore Hospital. A wonderful man, lived 95 years, children, great-grandchildren, and yet 95 years and he's been washed away, and each one of us will be. And he goes looking for what gives meaning or purpose, and he works his way through 12 chapters and finds what is it? And then in the last two verses of the book, the last two verses of the little epilogue, he tells you what it is. What is the key that gives life meaning and purpose? What it is that is worth living for, in fact, worth dying for? What will hold life together? And the answer is, I'm not going to tell you. I'll tell you why. Because if you don't walk the walk through those 12 chapters, and they're only short, if you don't do that, you won't get it. You won't feel the weight of it. It'll be like reading the last page of a novel. You know, oh, the butler did it, so what? Right? Or the last 5 minutes of a movie. If you walk the walk with him, you'll get it. And he will tell you what it is that gives life purpose. But I can tell you what it's not. It's not religion or being religious. It's not being moral and it's not self-improvement. I'll tell you why. Because the you that's inside there, the you that's listening to this, is real. You are not an illusion. You are perhaps the most real thing of all. I'll tell you why. Because there's a God, a personal God who made you as a person. And that personal God made you to know him. In fact, the claim of Christianity is that personal God has stepped into our world so that we can know him, so that he could win forgiveness for us at a great cost. And so that's where this leads. But I'd like to motivate you, to invite you to read Ecclesiastes. We've put together this a reading guide that it doesn't cover the whole 12 chapters, but it'll walk you along the walk. And you might remember I said at Uluru, we got a local guide. The guide showed us a whole lot of extra stuff that we would have missed. And so to read through this with someone who's a guide, maybe even better.